very nice fixture out of plywood with hinges and whatever, and a very fancy looking capacitor, where yours is a much neater thing with ways of adjusting it, measuring it, high voltage probes and so on. So I can tell you're setting up the instrumentation so that you're going to be able to really...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Now, Wes's laboratory, you're going to start seeing it in some of his YouTube videos. And if you go to QRZ.com and plug in KC2WGB, you'll see a picture of six solid pictures of John's laboratory. Well, these two laboratories are, by my standards, very well equipped for home laboratories. I mean, these are almost commercial installations by my standards. I've worked for companies that have had less instrumentation than that. They were manufacturing stuff and shipping it and trying to make a profit. So,
Nick, if you can, a quick question before you start with Wes.
Go ahead, John.
All right, Nick, I've been experimenting with my 805, the spotted lines. I have a discrepancy between the actual measurements. They come to a different point on each line. So what I'd like to do, I just wanted to check with you first. I'm going to take the transport heads. I'm going to mount both of them on a single slotted line and measure a waveform, the length of the wave, and then I'm going to do the same thing on the other slotted line. I think I have a bent detector probe because I'm getting a difference of about a half a millimeter. How do you think that'll work out?
I vaguely remember that the carriage on the slotted line 805 that I used to use was a removable subassembly, and therefore, in theory, you could remove it. You could take a small right-angle carpenter's triangle and hold it up against the probe and confirm whether or not the probe comes out of that face in a thoroughly perpendicular manner. So a bent probe is something you and I could confirm mathematically. By the way, a half a millimeter is, by my standards, an extremely small amount of error. And yet the probe could be bent 1 millimeter. And the way it slants, now it'd be, if the tip of it is a half a millimeter advanced or retarded in the forward and reverse direction of the slotted line, you would get a half a millimeter difference in where the null falls. And as you've already discovered, the null is nice and sharp, the peak is very broad, and so you look for the nulls in order to make the measurement. Let me drop. But most of the frequencies that you and I are likely to use, let's say, for instance, you made a measurement at 432 megacycles, where the wavelength is 27 inches. The wavelength is roughly 70 centimeters. If I got that right. Yeah, 70 centimeters is the wavelength. And a millimeter is a tenth of a centimeter. So you have an error of one half of, let me think now, 700. You have a 1,400-to-1 ratio error when you're making a half millimeter error at 432 megacycles. Roughly a 14-to-1, one part in 1,400 if I did the math right. I think I did. One part in 1,400. So a half millimeter error. For academic reasons, you're an exacting guy and you want it to go away. If you didn't know it was there and you ignored it, and you made a precise measurement of a particular load, and you thought the load was 51 ohms of resistance and 421 ohms of capacitive reactance. Because of your half millimeter error, the 421 ohms of capacitive reactance will come out 419 ohms of capacitive reactance. I know you can live with that. So what you're seeking is academic, and I think you've got a good guess as to what's going on. The slotted line itself, as long as the connectors on the end are the identical connectors, and as long as nobody has done something funny with the capacitive loading on the end, with, you know, the structure that holds the center conductor in place and gave you a slightly different velocity factor, as long as nobody's done anything along those lines, the two of them should really track. But also would be nice to flip the carriage from line number one over to line number two. Over to you, John. KC2WGB. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Well, Dick, the funny thing, if you picture that in your mind, it doesn't make a difference. It's still accurate. The amount of millimeters, if I scale down from, say, 10 millimeter to 20 millimeters, the tracking is perfect because the bend doesn't change. But the strange thing is, if there's an adjustment knob on top which raises and lowers the probe, Well, when you turn that, the point will go into either an ellipse or a circle if it was bent. That, I don't notice a difference at that point. So it really was strange. So I was thinking of mounting both carriages on one and then taking specific measurements and wavelengths, then put them both on another one and see if I can find out which one of these things are in error. But, okay, I just wanted to run that by you. We can pick up with Wesley. I just wanted to see what your thoughts were on it.
Hey, you brought up another very good point. The way a person usually uses a slotted line is the exact length of transmission line that leaves the slotted region of the slotted line, goes through the interfacing connectors, goes through the adapter, goes into the transmission line that goes to the device that you're measuring. That length of line, electronically, you might not know the exact length of it. Therefore, the average way a person uses a slotted line is that at the end of his transmission line that he has added that goes over to and touches the thing that he wants to measure. He's got this little black box. He hangs it on the end of his pigtail of transmission line that he's connected to the end of his slotted line. And what the average person will do is put a known short circuit and open circuit on the end of that pigtail, find out where the nulls on the slotted line are. They become the reference points. Then you put on the real unknown thing that you want to measure and find out how much the null points move closer or further away, and then you interpret the data. You find out what is the ratio of the peak to valley and how far did the nulls move. And you go to the right mathematics, and that tells you everything you want to know about that load, as long as you don't get things upside down. When you're doing a real slotted line Smith chart type measurement, my goodness, there's a lot of ways you can get things backwards. Whereas a modern-day vector network analyzer has a computer program built inside that does all that for you. As long as you've done a proper calibration procedure, it does a beautiful job. And by the way, the next time that HAL is around, K6, WPZ, is it? DPZ, K6DPZ. Next time HAL is around, I'd like to talk to him because in his honor, I made a double measurement. This
repeater, timeout, cancel.
In his honor, I made a double measurement on a network analyzer this week. The factory that I normally go to has not one, but three vector network analyzers sitting in one particular laboratory. And the three of them are unused quite a few hours per day. So I made a simultaneous measurement on two separate vector network analyzers. One vector network analyzer had a 2-foot cable coming out of it, the test cable, and the other one had a 5-foot cable approximately coming out of it. And the calibration was done at the end of those two cables. And I took the calibration kit from the two. They each had a 50-ohm calibrating resistor. I put them into a T connector. So the two 50-ohm resistors on a T-connector gives you something very close to 25 ohms, very close to a 2-to-1 VISWR. I first measured the 2-to-1 VISWR on network analyzer number 1 with a 2-foot cable. I then made the vector network analyzer measurement on vector network analyzer number 2 that had the 5-foot cable. And what do you think was the difference in the measurement that I measured there, John? Make a guess. KC2WGB, K2LIW.
I'll take a shot at zero.
You got it. In other words, the length of the cable did not change the apparent impedance the vector network analyzer measured. But then I said, well, wait a minute now. When you calibrate the vector network analyzer, you're going through a short, open, and load calibration procedure at the end of your test cable. So the machine, with all of its internal mathematics, references everything at the end of that test piece of cable. So if the machine cranks out mathematically the length of the cable when you do a good cal procedure, therefore the fact that one had a 2-foot cable and one had a 5-foot cable appears to be a no-brainer. I said, yeah, I sort of understand that. The next thing I did is I took the 2-foot cable out of machine number 1 and mounted it on machine number 2. I took the 5-foot cable out of machine number 1 and mounted on machine number 5-foot cable out of machine number 2 and mounted on machine number 1 without doing a recal. I switched the cables. Now tell me what you think I measured. KC2WGB, K2LIW.
I think from my experience, the number one analyzer is going to show you a 3-foot error on that cable, and you're going to get a 3-foot error on the other one.
In a way, you're right. In other words, when I looked at the 2-to-1 Vizwarg dot on the screen at first, on the 2 before I switched the cables, the dot was halfway between the center of the Smith chart and the left-hand side, halfway between 0 ohms and the center of the Smith chart, approximately. Maybe it was a third of the way, but you know what I mean. It was at the 2-to-1, the dot was on the 2-to-1 Vizwarg circle. When I switched the cables, the dot moved to another place on the chart, but it's on the exact same circle. On the two non-disturbed network analyzers, I measured 2-to-1 standing wave ratio. I measured now, when I switched the cables, a different phase angle, yes, but I still measured exactly a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio. The standing wave ratio did not change. I just rotated the phase. Because the signal going down the cable, hitting the load and reflecting back, the 2-to-1 load reflects 1/3 of the voltage. I got that right. I think it is, yes. 1/3 of the voltage, 9.5 dB down. The amount of reflection stayed the same. But because in one case it went down a longer cable than the other case, it came back at a different phase angle, which makes the machine display the dot in a different place on the Smith chart, but it is still the exact same distance from the center of the chart. It's still a 2-to-1 Vizwarg. Over to you, John, K2LIW.
Well, like you said, Dick, no-brainer, because isn't that how a phased array works?
You're absolutely right. There's one kind of a phased array you can build where you have shorter cables going to some of the radiating antennas, elements, and longer cables going to the other, and that electronically steers the beam. But still, in theory, all the power going down that phasing harness and all those power dividers in that phased array antenna, as long as each of your elements are 50 ohm elements, all of that energy goes down there and arrives at the right time, at the right amplitude, at each one of the radiating elements, and eventually it synthesizes that beam that goes out into space at your particular desired angle and your particular desired beam width in azimuth and elevation. So switching the cables did not change the Vizwarg. The reason I did that experiment is that Hal and a lot of people are reasonably convinced that if you adjust your transmission line to the right length, you'll make the Vizwarg disappear. And I'm saying, no, you cannot do that. If you've got error in your instrumentation, you may think that is happening. And there's many ways you can misinterpret. But as long as you're putting in low-loss cable of the exact same impedance, changing the length of your transmission line does not change the Vizwarg one iota. It changes the phase angle of it, doesn't change the magnitude. You probably already knew that. A lot of people don't, John. You'd be amazed how many people are positive they can choose a magic length, and some of them say it's got to be an odd number of quarter wavelengths. Some say it's got to be even number of half wavelengths and whatever. They've all got their favorite formula for the magic length of cable that'll make the standing wave ratio of their antenna disappear. And I'm convinced that that is not true, even though a lot of people believe it. The majority believes that, I could almost say. Over to you, John, K2LIW.
Yes, a lot of people do believe that. I've heard of people saying, trim off another inch of your cable, do this and that, and I believe you're right. It's only a question of phase. I believe that now from talking to you over the years and also from experiments I made in my laboratory. But I'll tell you one thing I found very interesting. I never owned the electrowire bridge or the line, but I've had these two HP 805s, and they are extremely accurate for a very crude instrument. If you look at it, there's really not much there, but they are extremely accurate. I've used them to calibrate, to check the calibration on generators, and they're almost exact, right on the money. So there's a lot to be said for a delay line if you can't afford an analyzer, that's for sure. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, I think a person could easily build electrowires, as the ham radio operators used to do in the 20s, 1920s. An enthusiastic guy with a good machine shop like you or Wes could easily build an 805 slotted line. There's no great magic in there. Just those two flat plates inside with that rod going down the center. As long as the dimensions of the diameter of the rod and the spacing between the plates is right, it will be a 50-ohm line. And then to make a carriage that slides along there and samples that signal is a relatively easy thing to do with a millimeter scale on the outside so you know where the carriage is. So it is a very exacting science, the way that thing works. And it's a hell of a lot cheaper than a vector network analyzer. The vector network analyzers on the surplus market are either the really old ones that are very clunky and hard to use. Let me drop.
Enter the UU.
Frank recognized. Get you in a minute, Frank. They're either the clunky old ones that are very hard to use, or the new ones that are microprocessor controlled and a lot easier and more friendly, much more user friendly, but my goodness, are they expensive. They start off at numbers like $40,000 brand new. And on the surplus market, you probably can't get one that you'd like to own for less than 15 grand. And for an item that the average amateur radio operator is going to use five times per year, it's not easy to justify a $15,000 expenditure. Now, if you get a club of 300 members, and you jointly as a club buy a $15,000 used piece of equipment and share it among the 300 members, yes, now you're getting your money's worth, as long as they all treat it with tender loving care. So I wonder if you've used lecture wires or things like that out at Radio Central, I think it was called. Let's see, Radio Central is where I think you were associated, Frank. I was associated with the RCA site out, loosely associated with the RCA site out at Riverhead when I removed their 130-foot tower and their 28-foot dish. That's another whole story. N2NNU to take it. Make sure you wait for the beep, Frank. K2RYW in the TechNet.
Yeah, I was referring to what you were saying earlier about trimming coax, adding. I've done that relentlessly for about 40 years, even when I was a CB operator, 20 years on 11 meters and about 22 years as an amateur. I've done it on 2 meters. I've done it on 440. I haven't done much of it on HF, which is always a good old tuner, of course. You mean to tell me I've wasted my time? Because I used to bring down a 2-meter band and a good SWR meter. I got quite a few of them around here, quite a few meters. I think the best one with the best accuracy, it would be up to 2, a little over 2. And, of course, we're all, most of our amateurs are SWR crazy. Let me drop it a second. Most of the guys I know, and I probably know hundreds, still know some, were SWR nuts. You will not go to sleep until you get it down. And I brought it down to 1.2, 1.3. You mean I was wasting my time for 22 years? I was not really doing much better. Wasn't protecting the radio. Give me a little feedback on that, because I just walked in and I heard part of your conversation.
Yeah, I'm glad you asked, Frank. I'm now going to go to the next part of the story. Like everything else, there's more to it than first meets the eye. If you had pure 50-ohm cable and a real antenna with a ballon on the end of the transmission line, so you've got a balloning device that takes your unbalanced coaxial cable and feeds your maybe balanced antenna, maybe it's a dipole, and you've got a real ballon at the end, so you're feeding the dipole correctly. In that particular situation, changing the length of the cable will not change the standing wave ratio one iota, because standing wave ratio is really reflected power ratio. Of the power going up the antenna, because the antenna is not a pure 50-ohm load, a certain amount of it reflects back, and that amount that reflects back does not change if you're adding and subtracting some lossless line. And the couple of feet that you're adding, you don't talk about the loss, so to say. So changing the length of that line does not change the percentage of reflected power. There's a catch. Many of us will be using a antenna tuner that has certain regions it can cover of the Smith chart, and when you change the length of the line, you're now rotating the signal into another portion of the chart. You're not changing the magnitude of the biswar. That's the length of the radius of the circle you swing around the center of the chart. That circle is a 2-to-1 biswar circle, we'll say. You're not changing the VISRAR, but you go to a different portion of that, and maybe that portion of the Smith chart is better covered by your particular antenna tuner. That's one factor, where the antenna tuner becomes happier. That's the minor factor. Let me drop. But in the case of a real dipole antenna, you think the dipole is a long piece of wire with an insulator in the center, and you're feeding it at the center. You think it is a composite antenna, and you're feeding it at the center. And your eye sees that, and your brain sees that. Mother Nature does not see that. Mother Nature sees that as a pair of monopole antennas back to back. The right-hand side of the dipole is a monopole. It needs a counterpoise. The left-hand side of the dipole is a monopole, and it needs a counterpoise. Call it a non-squiggly rubber duck. You got a rubber duck to the right and a rubber duck to the left. And when you're feeding energy into the right-hand dipole, you're subtracting it from the left-hand dipole on the first half cycle. On the second half cycle, you do the other. So on the first half cycle, you could say the right-hand side of the dipole is active, the left-hand side is the counterpoise. On the second half cycle, you reverse those two positions. Because Mother Nature considers that as two separate monopole antennas, and each one is operating independently to the rest of the universe. Now you see the problem. You got a piece of coax cable going up there. You didn't bother putting in the balloning device. It's not a crime, but half of us do that. You connect the shield to the left-hand side of the dipole. You connect the center conductor to the right-hand side. The signal flowing down the center of the coax cable, let me drop. The signal flowing down the center of the coax cable is in a beautiful shielded environment. None of that goes out into the air. But then you come to the end of the cable. You're now launching a whole lot of signal from center conductor over to the right-hand side of the dipole. But that current you're launching has to come from somewhere, action and reaction. You're drawing the current from the left-hand side. Mother Nature tries to create a balance. She doesn't quite succeed, but she comes close. If you really measured the voltage right at the center insulator, the RF voltage to ground on the right-hand side of the dipole and the left-hand side of the dipole, you'll find that those two voltages are fairly close to even to each other. If you got 1 volt RMS on the right-hand side, you're going to have 0.8 volt RMS on the left-hand side to ground. There's voltage on the left-hand side of the dipole. Otherwise, you wouldn't bother putting it there. And what is the left-hand side connected to? It's connected to the shield of the coax. The bottom line is that because the antenna is attempting to be really balanced, at the antenna, you're launching current that goes back down the outside of the coax cable. It's not a shielded structure anymore. Now the length of that cable comes back to the shack. It looks at the transmitter as a grounded object. You're now changing the line length to ground. And as that line length goes in and out of resonance, it becomes another shunt inductor or a shunt capacitor that you think you're putting it... you think you're adjusting the length of the cable. You're really putting a capacitor or an inductor to ground on the left-hand side of the dipole up at the antenna, but you're doing it down at the shack by adjusting that length of cable. So now in that particular case, because of the lack of a balancing device, you are changing the VISRAR because you're changing the length of the outside cable, which is part of the radiating structure. Turn.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
It turns out that probably one-third of your signal is now being radiated by the outside of the coax cable. The outside of the coax cable is now part of the antenna because you didn't put a balun there. And now as you adjust the length of that cable, you're adjusting the length of that balun. You would have seen a similar change in the standing wave ratio. Assuming you got a good VISRAR meter. You would have seen a similar change in the VISRAR meter if you just took the length of cable coming down to the shack and simply coiled it. You're now adding another inductor by coiling it. You'd be changing the resonant length electronically, and you'd watch the VISRAR going up and down as you do that. So you're not even adding a subtracting cable. You're just changing the way you're using it by coiling it. A poor man's balun would be a four or five turns of coax cable taped together right up at the dipole. That is a poor man's balun. Or a real, unideller. These things that got ferrite beads inside is another real balun. So does it change the VISRAR? Yes and no, but not for the reason that people understand at first. I think you see a little bit of what's going on there, Frank. N2, NNU, K2LIW in the tech net. Wait for the beep.
VH1AY would comment on this subject.
Anyhow, I had yours wrong, too. I had to rewrite it. See what you thought about. I could comprehend it. I might not be able to explain it to somebody in the technical terms you can, but I could pretty much understand it. You're pretty much fooling yourself by seeing that SWR come down. It's just not really coming down. But you're feeling better about it. Most hams will go, whew, wow, finally got it down by trimming. Well, I'll be honest, that's what I've done for about 40 years. But you're fooling yourself. And the balance, yeah, I've made enough four-man's balance. All three antennas have them on. Specific length, specific amount of turns, and just tape it together. And you know what? I found it always worked as well as any balance I bought. I never seen a difference. Well, at least I won't be wasting my time anymore trying to trim coax, because it's just fooling you. It's just going to make you feel better. So I'll have to tell all the other hams out there, don't waste your time. You're making yourself feel better. Make sure you got a balance there.
Joe recognized, and now let me correct you again, Frank. Turns out you really were changing the Vizwa, but not for the reason you thought. Everyone thinks there's a magic length of 50-ohm cable where a 2-to-1 Vizwa will come back to a 50-ohm resistor. If the antenna was a thoroughly balanced antenna, or if you were putting a 25-ohm resistor inside of a shielded box up at the antenna, and the coax cable went to that shielded box, now changing the length of the cable would not make any difference. But because your dipole is a structure that Mother Nature tries very hard to use it in a balanced manner, she's therefore going to launch signal back down onto your outside of your coax. Your coax now has RF current flowing on it. Your coax outside shield is now part of the antenna. It's part of the radiating system. And now you can bring that third component. The right-hand side of the dipole is component number one. The left-hand side of the component is component number two. The shield of the coax cable with the current flowing on the outside of it is component number three. And you've got three components in that antenna. And you're changing the length of the third component. It's part of the radiating structure. Believe it or not, you really are changing the Vizwa. You were doing the right thing. You had some RF in the shack, and maybe you didn't like that. If you were using a D104 mic and you were running a kilowatt, you might draw an arc between your lip and the metal screening on the front of that D104 mic because of the RF in the shack, because of what's flowing down the outside of the cable. So you really were tuning the Vizwa. It wasn't as much of a wasted factor as you think, but for very different reasons. It was the third component of the antenna. I think that made some sense to you, Frank, before I go over to Joe. N2VUU, K2LIW.
Yep, I got it. I got it in my mind. Yep, I'm glad I was listening in tonight. That makes a lot of sense. And that shock with my D104, which is right here, connected to my HF, I've gotten that already. Didn't feel too good. Put a Valmon on, did a few other things, changed. I went from coax, I went to 300 ohm twin lead. And for reasons unexplained, capacitance, inductance, reaction, and we can keep going. It worked. Yeah, I got that shock, and I got many others, but I could see your point. It's reflecting back. In my mind, it's there. Oh, I have to thank you for that one. At least I got a full understanding of it now.
Is there a question about the diameter of the coil, WS2N?
Yeah, it's not very critical. The diameter of the coil, because the coil is a known diameter that you're going to generate, you can decide to make it 1 foot, 2 feet, whatever. You can decide to make it 2 turns, 5 turns, whatever. And you want to know, what's the right number of turns? There's an easy way you can find that one out. Let me drop. You go to one of the very early chapters in the Radio Amateur's Handbook, where they tell about inductance and reactance and capacitance. And in there, you'll find a formula for a solenoid coil. And that formula, as you plug in what is the diameter of the coil, what's the length of the coil, and how many turns does it have, you plug in those numbers, and that formula will tell you how many microhenries is that coil that you just made, that you're taping together. And who cares if there's a 20% error? If you're looking for a 4 microhenry coil and you turn and you generate a 3.5 microhenry, close enough. It doesn't have to be exact. But once you know the number of microhenries of the coil and you know the frequency you're operating at, 3.75 megacycles, you look that up on the chart or you plug it into the formula, X sub L equals 2 pi FL, either way, with your handheld calculator and that formula, or you look at the right chart that's in that exact same chapter, you'll know how many ohms of inductive reactance that many microhenries, which is really that number of turns of that diameter, is going to have. And how many ohms of inductive reactance are you looking for? If it's a 50 ohm antenna, if it's a 70 ohm antenna, and you want the current flowing down the outside to at least be a 10 to 1 ratio lower, make it a 700 ohm reactor. So the right number of microhenries. So that coil is now a 700 ohm inductive reactance. It's now going to be a pretty darn good choke to a 70 ohm antenna. The choking action you've got is 10 times higher than the impedance of the antenna. I think you see the process there, Joe. John, for, here we go. Paul, WS2N first, then we're going to go to Joe. WS2N, K2LIW. Yeah, did it make some sense to you, Paul?
I was trying to do it without doing all the formulas. And, you know, I got a 20-meter dipole and a 40-meter dipole. I'd like to do it. 80, 40, and a 20. I'd like to, you know, in other words, if it was a system, and I could do 3 coils, 8 inches in diameter for every one, it sure would make things faster if I got to start. Figure out this one's going to get 5 loops and this one's going to get 3 inches of diameter. That becomes a lot more work.
I'm glad you said what you did. Let's assume that the worst case is you built a fan dipole. A fan dipole has got a dipole on 80, 40, 20, 15, and 10 all connected together, and they're all separated a little bit at the ends. And you got one piece of transmission line going to the whole conglomerate of fan dipole. The lowest frequency is the one that's the worst case. The lowest frequency, because the formula for inductive reactance is 2 pi, which is a constant times the inductor in microhenry or in henries, and the frequency in cycles. You're going to get the least amount of inductance reactance at the lowest frequency. So if you calculate the right amount of coil for 80 meters, the lowest frequency in my example, you're going to get twice the amount of inductive reactance at 40 meters. You're going to get 4 times the amount of inductive reactance at 20 meters, and so on. As long as you've got enough choking action at 80 meters, you're going to get more and more choking action as you go up in frequency. So just wind the one for the lowest frequency, and it works on all of them. Having too much choke is not bad. Just means you're wasting a little bit of coax cable on the highest frequency. If it was a pure 10-meter dipole, and you put a choke on there that's good for 80 meters, nothing bad will happen. You just use a little more cable than you had to. WS2N, K2LIW.
Okay, very good. No problem. I got more coax than I know what to do with. Very good, Dick.
Joe, wait for the beep and you got it. W2LYY, K2LIW.
I wasn't listening to the whole conversation in detail. I don't know who brought the subject about the different lengths of transmission lines with respect to visual or what you see reflective power. I've noticed that myself with either bird watt meter or just with the internal SWR meter within a transceiver itself. You can play around with that kind of thing. Don't these devices within themselves, bird watt meter or either these add-on meters or the ones that come in the ring, don't they tend to work on RF voltage other than more than RF current? And I'm asking that specifically because isn't it the voltage nodes along the cable that is really being detected as you change the length of the cable with respect to the total length of your transmission lines that these things are seeing? So thusly you can pull your equipment, so to speak, thinking you have a better match as you change your line length, but you're really, looking at a different voltage node or part of the voltage node on the cable.
The words that you just used, Joe, if I did a survey of the guys on 20 meters tomorrow morning, 95% of the guys would agree with you. Good sounding common sense. Good horse sense. Dead wrong. a properly operating bird wattmeter. You think it's got a loop of wire inside of that slug that you plug in, and you think that loop of wire is picking up, depending on which way you think it's picking up the voltage flowing through, or you think it's picking up the current that's flowing through. And you think that whether or not the node of the standing wave ratio, node of current or node of voltage, if it falls in the middle of the Berg wattmeter, you think it's going to behave differently than if it falls on the peak instead of the node in the middle of the wattmeter. The answer is absolutely not. You can prove that to yourself if you own a trombone device and you put your trombone in between the output of the Berg wattmeter and a 2-to-1 Viswah or a short circuit, but you measure the forward power, you measure the reverse power on the Berg wattmeter, and then you operate the trombone. If the Berg wattmeter is working correctly, it will not move. It'll show you the forward power going into the short circuit. It'll show you the reflected power coming back from the short circuit. And as you move that trombone, the only thing that will move is your transmitter. As it sees different impedances, the power output of the transmitter goes up and down. But as long as you keep calibrating forward power to reverse power ratio, or if you had a real 50-ohm transmitter, you can do that by, let me drop. You could start off with a 100-watt transmitter, put it to a high-power 10 dB attenuator assembly, and the output of the attenuator is now very close to a 50-ohm source. You're doing that because your real transmitter is a constant current generator. It's almost an open circuit. Any power you reflect back to it, it re-reflects forward and it confuses the hell out of you. Put a 10 dB power attenuator in there so that your 100-watt transmitter goes to a 10 dB attenuator and 10 watts comes out. Now you use the 10-watt full-scale slug on the Berg wattmeter and you measure the forward and reverse power into a short circuit with a trombone and you operate the trombone. Nothing will move. The Berg wattmeter, the slug on the Berg wattmeter, when it's properly operating and properly calibrated, in the forward mode, is looking at forward power, and it sees no reverse power. You flip the slug, and it sees reverse power, and it sees no forward power. Those nodes that you talk about, the peaks and the valleys, what you see on the slotted line, is true only if forward power and reverse power are there simultaneously, and you're using a probe, which is that little wire coming out of that carriage on the Bird 80, on the Hewlett-Packard 805. That piece of wire is a non-directional voltage sensing device. The coaxial cable keeps the forward power and the reverse power thoroughly separated. It does not mix them. But that little probe on the 805 on the carriage is a non-directional voltage sensing device. It mixes the forward voltage and the reverse voltage for the first time. It mixes them, puts them into its diode detector, and then puts it into your 415 indicator machine, after seeing the 1KC component, if you know what I mean. So your Berg wattmeter looks at forward power independent. There are no peaks and valleys inside of that slug of that Berg wattmeter. Ain't that crazy? W-H-U-R-Y-Y-H-U-R-I-W.
I know what you're saying within the slug, but I'm talking about how you place it on the line. Does the detector slug in a Berg wattmeter, since you're using that as an example, is that detecting RF current, RF voltage, or a combination of both to give you an indication on your meter?
I could safely say it is looking at RF voltage, it is looking at RF current, it is multiplying the two together with the phase angle. It is really making forward power measurement, very similar to the watt-hour meter on the side of your house. Independent of the phase angle or independent of the cosine theta or whatever, what do we call it now? Phase percentage, you know what I mean. If you've got rotary machinery, magnetic rotary machinery in your house, and you've got a heavy inductive current, that watt-hour meter on the side of your house takes that all into account and gives you the exact number of watts, not of the volt amperes you're consuming, the real watt-hours you're consuming is what it measures. The Berg wattmeter does that. It really measures independent forward power, independent reverse power. Inside of that Berg wattmeter, inside of that slug of the Berg wattmeter, what you think is a null of voltage or a null of current does not exist. Here's the next experiment you can do to prove that. Let me drop. If you wanted to, you could make a modified version of the slug of a bird watt meter, and you could mount it as the carriage on a slotted line, an 805 slotted line, and you create a great big visuar at one end of the slotted line, put 100 watts of power into the slotted line to make sure you got enough sensitivity, because the bird slug meter, the slug doesn't go down far enough. You'd have to make a modified slug. But you properly calibrate the slug so that it has real directivity, and you operate that on the slotted line, and you put a great big heavy visuar on the output of the slotted line, and then you move that slug of the watt meter along the carriage, as the carriage of the 805, you'd get an eye-opener. Nothing would change. In the forward mode, you'd measure forward power. You slide it up and down, and it wouldn't move one iota. You reverse the slug on the 805. You see now the power reflecting from the load, and you move it up and down across the hold-on slotted line, and it wouldn't move, because it is a directional power meter. That little whisker of a wire that's really on the carriage of a Hewlett-Packard 805 slotted line is a voltage sensing device with no directivity. It looks at the forward voltage and measures it. It looks at the reverse flowing voltage, and measures it. And it adds the two together in a voltage vector manner, puts both of them into the crystal diode detector. Out comes the 1KC component that goes into your 415 indicator meter. It's a non-directional detector. But your slug of your Berg watt meter is a directional detector, obvious by the fact you can aim it forward or aim it reverse. It tells you how many watts are coming out of the transmitter, and it tells you how many watts are coming back down from the antenna. Independently, if it's properly operating and properly calibrated, it does not mix those two together. Inside of the Berg watt meter, there is no
repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout, cancel.
Inside of that Berg watt meter, there is no voltage null, there is no current null. You can move that watt meter up and down that line, and nothing should change. There's a catch. You do it by changing the length of the cable, and if you've got a hot cable, as I was telling Frank before, now you're changing the resonant length of the radiating system, bringing it in and out of resonance, changing the impedance of the antenna, and now all hell will break loose. By the way, the Berg watt meter is a beautifully shielded device. That slug picks up a sample of the forward power going down that cable. And even though you've got a hot cable because it's part of the antenna system and you weren't using a balun, and you got a lot of RF energy flowing on the outside, a properly operating Berg watt meter will not respond to that. It only responds to what the slug picks up, and it's sampling what's happening an eighth of an inch away from that center line inside the Berg watt meter. And the RF you put on the outside, within reason, it doesn't respond to it. The B2RYY, K2RYW.
Okay, I understand what you're saying, but I've used a Berg 43 watt meter, and I've purposely changed the cable length between the transmission line and the meter, and left the length between the transmitter and the Berg watt meter the same. And if you have a visual effect on the cable where it's not a perfect match, you will see the watt meter change. It'll give you sometimes a lower, sometimes a higher indicator of forward power. Same thing how it will happen with reflective power. It'll change as indicated on the Berg watt meter.
You're absolutely right in what you observed, but the interpretation is the problem. There's two or three things going on at once here, Joe. Number one, if you weren't using a balun at the antenna, a dipole, and you've got the shield going to one side of the dipole and the center conductor go to the other side, because Mother Nature forces that dipole to be almost balanced in space, it really is two monopoles back to back. You think it's a dipole. She doesn't look at it that way. She is launching some current back down the outside of that cable. The right-hand side of the dipole is radiator number one. The left-hand side of the dipole is radiator number two. The coax cable, which has just become hot, is radiator number three. It's part of your antenna. As you change the length of the cable from the output of the Berg watt meter into the antenna, you change the length of the cable, you change the length of part of the radiating system. You brought that antenna into and out of resonance by changing that length of cable because the cable is hot. You didn't even have to change the length of the cable, Joe. If there was enough cable in the shack with you and you simply coiled the cable and made it an inductor, you would have watched the Berg watt meter change. That's one thing that's happening. You were changing the length of the radiator, bringing the total antenna system into and out of resonance. That's one thing you were doing. Second of all, as you change the length of the cable, the phase angle of the Vizwar seen by the transmitter makes the power output of the transmitter go up and down. Your transmitter gives you rated performance at a 50-ohm resistive load. Let me drop. And therefore, when you're running in the sideband mode, you get the 33 dB of third-order intermodulation distortion. You get the real performance the manufacturer has guaranteed if you put it into a 50-ohm resistive load. But now you do a careful measurement on your particular transmitter. You may find out it puts out maximum power with a 25-ohm load. Your transmitter might do that. You operate it with a 25-ohm load. You don't have the linearity anymore. You're going to be flat-topping on your sideband output. But if you're running in the Morse code mode, you might be very happy with a 25-ohm load. So as you change the length of the cable, and if the antenna happened to be a 2-to-1 Vizwar, cable, antenna plus the hotness of the cable going in and out of resonance, the length of the feed line, if you happen to have a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio, which means that at a certain length of cable, the transmitter is going to see 25 ohms, and another length of cable, the transmitter is going to see 100 ohms. As you're changing the length of the cable, the power output of the transmitter is going up and down. You'd be amazed how many guys say that, hey, I'm correcting the Vizwar. I want to make the reflected power go down. They set the bird watt meter into the reflected power mode and leave it there as they make the cable go longer and shorter. You'd be amazed how many guys who fall into that trap. They don't go back and recalibrate forward versus reverse power. And so you can see there's all kinds of things going on. Transmitter is changing in power output. Antenna is changing in resonance. And you think all you're doing is changing the length of the coax cable and looking for the 50-ohm point. So H-U-R-Y-Y, K-2-R-I-W.
Okay, I have noticed that. It's amazing what you can find out with it by talking about these different subjects and bringing them up. I guess others are probably out there have probably seen the same thing over the years. Back to you.
Yeah, one of the things that very few people do is measure how hot the cable is. I built a test fixture at the laboratory where I work most of the time, where I can measure the amount of current, the amount of RF current flowing on the outside of a coaxial transmission line. I built a fixture that does that. You'd be amazed how simple it is. It's simply a piece of semi-rigid cable that lies parallel to the main semi-rigid cable, and it's got a loop of wire on the end of it. The center conductor of the measuring cable loops back onto itself, so it becomes a current probe. The only thing that's not quite right about it is I can't slide that function, but by way of that loop that's right on the outside of the main transmission line, and it's in the plane of the transmission line. The loop is a small loop, probably a half-inch diameter, because I'm doing this at 900 megs. I can easily measure the current that's on that cable, because as the current flows down that cable, it makes magnetic field that wraps around the cable like the fingers on your hand. If you grab the cable in your hand with the thumb going in the direction of the cable and your fingers are wrapping around the cable, the current flowing on the cable is making a magnetic field that does that. It looks like your fingers. And now those fingers of magnetic field go through that loop on my sensing circuit. And therefore I can tell right away if current is flowing on the transmission line. As we build antennas and we try to make them a balanced structure, and sometimes they end up a little bit unbalanced because they're sitting on the same printed circuit board with a whole lot of other electronics. Let me drop. You think you've got a balanced antenna, but the actual trunk of electronics, the antenna is mounted on the printed circuit board, and an inch and a half away you've got an integrated circuit, you've got a transmitter, you've got a display device. 2 inches away you've got the handle that the person holds onto. That's on the outside of the package, but the printed circuit board doesn't know that. It's a nearby device. So for a whole bunch of reasons, that antenna that you think started off as balanced in the real world ends up as an unbalanced structure, and current flows down its transmission line. And with that sensing circuit, that sniffer I call it, I can measure approximately that amount of current. Of course, that current has got a little bit of a standing wave to it, and if I could slide it along the transmission line, it would be a little bit better. But at least I get an indication. I think you see the operation there, Joe. W2LYY, K2LYW.
Very interesting. And how did you calibrate this to give you an accurate reading? I guess you're measuring current in RF milliamperes, RF amperes? What are you measuring actually as an end of your results and end product?
I'm going to admit that the calibration is pretty rough. I could easily be wrong by 2 to 1. But if I want the amount of current flowing on the cable to be 1 milliampere, and it's really 100 milliamperes of RF, I can easily sense that. If I want to make sure it's 1 milliampere and I measure 1.5, can I be sure? Of course not. What I did to calibrate it is to put a monopole antenna on the end of that transmission line with no counterpoise and launched signal into that monopole. I knew how much signal I'm putting into the monopole. Because there is no counterpoise, and the only place it can borrow the current from to launch it into the monopole is from the shield of the coax cable that's right at that point. The monopole antenna hung from the center conductor in midair, and the shield of the coax cable just went up to that monopole and stopped without touching it. So in that case, on that antenna, I know how much current, within reason, within a 2-to-1 ratio, I know how much current I'm launching into that cable. And then I looked at how many, what is the dBm coming out of that sniffer. The sniffer goes into a network analyzer, and I measure that power in dBm. So for a known number of dBm going into the monopole, I got a known number of dBm coming out of the sniffer. That was the calibration procedure. It's rough, but it's close enough. It does the job. Over to you, Joe.
And to XGN.
Joe first. Go ahead, Joe.
Taking this application another step further, using it in another type of market other than what you work in, could you have that thing actually give you a pretty good idea using it on VHF and UHF frequencies? Would the length of this constructed piece of cable have much of a difference as far as its sensitivity or a basic pickup in the low band, high band, or UHF parts of the RF spectrum? Back to you, Dick.
Once that sniffer is connected to a spectrum analyzer or a network analyzer, and a good spectrum analyzer has more than 100 decibels of dynamic range, a good network analyzer has 70 decibels of dynamic range. Even if my sniffer loop is too small and it's too insensitive and it's 20 dB down from ideal for that particular frequency, I built the thing and I made it for 915 megs, but now I'm using it at 50 megacycles. That's going to be a hell of a lot less sensitive. But that just means I crank up the gain a little bit more on the spectrum analyzer or the network analyzer and do a calibration procedure accordingly. So that's not a problem as long as you're using sensitive enough instrumentation. In the ideal world, it should be slidable along the transmission line so I can look at the peak and valley of current on the outside of the coax cable. And there's ways that I could do that. In my particular sniffer, the transmission line, the main transmission line going to the device under test, is a piece of unshielded, uninsulated, semi-rigid. It happens to be 141 semi-rigid coax cable. And the sniffer is soldered to it. It's another piece of 085 coax cable is the sniffer, and soldered to it. So the two are married. They don't have to be, but that's just the way I built it. And so the next embodiment would be to build some kind of a carriage so one could slide versus the other. But the insensitivity of lower frequencies is not a problem. That current flowing on the outside of the coax cable is still current lines that are like my fingers wrapping around that cable. And those current lines are going to go through the area of that loop of the sniffer. And it's going to see it. As I go to lower frequencies, the loop is less sensitive, but I can calibrate it at that frequency. Let's see what Wes is going to say about this. N2XJN, K2RAW. Go ahead, Wes.
VGV.
No, I'm trying to relate to the subject that we started an hour ago, but by the time five people jump in, I don't want to be, I mean, if there is a chance with your permission to come to the subject, because then I'm going to be left for another week with my questions, and that will not help me with the progress. So if you could pick up my subject, I'd appreciate that. N2XGN.
Okay, we'll go to John, and then your subject. Go ahead, John.
Oh, Dick, I just want to give you a little information. I was speaking to Wesley last week, and I put a bid in on a spectrum analyzer. You were talking about prices before. A Rodin Swartz. It was less than a year old, in pristine condition, with certificate traceable to the Bureau. I bid $30,000 on it. I missed by 12 grand. It went from 42. So you're right. They are expensive and not something for everybody. That's all. Just wanted to fill you in on that. KC2WGB.
Wow. By my standards, John, you are serious. A ham radio operator who is willing to pay 30 grand, even though it's an extremely quality instrument, and maybe from one point of view it's money in the bank, where a year from now you can get 95% of your money back on a machine like that. Rode makes... I haven't used a Rode... Yes, I have. I used a portable Rode spectrum analyzer. The main Rode that I use is a vector network analyzer, and I really love the thing. I find it twice as user-friendly as the Hewlett-Packard. That's the one that I use every day. That's the one that had the 5-foot length of cable on it on my previous measurements. So a ham radio operator that sets up a lab like yours that's in those pictures on QIZ.com and willing to pay 30 grand, wow. By my standards, you're serious, because some hams will say, gee, I'm going to use it 5 times per year. But 5 times per year, if I rented it, would not be quite as expensive as owning it. But I know darn well that, owning it is a lot nicer. You know its history. Whereas when you rent an instrument, awful nice machine to own. Okay, where do you stand? I'm getting the impression, Wes, from a couple of words I heard earlier, that you have started putting some voltage into your circuit, and maybe you've seen some arcing over and you're worried about high voltage standoff and so on. N2XJN, KQRIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, N2XJN. Yes, I was in the process of assembly, actually. Day by day I'm assembling, and I'm trying to do this very carefully. One of the problems that I have got, I have sent you a number of emails today. One of them is being called Fluke 5205A problem, PDF problem with overload lamp and fold lamp indicators. That's 10:15 of today. Now, what is happening with that is, and you have two links. One of them is data spec, and the other one is the instruction manual on it. I'm trying to find out what problem do I have between Fluke output and the Glenn's transformer. That's one of the things that I have to resolve. Other than that, I wouldn't be able to progress with that. I found in the manual some information that states that let me jump. The amplifier, which is the Fluke, is automatically set to standby condition. That's not that. Okay. Overload protection. Overload limit protects against input noise spikes and momentary output overload. Overload trip protects against input overdrive condition, steady-state output, overloads, and short circuits. That's what I have on it from the manual. I didn't read much about it. I specified my question exactly in that particular email of today. I was wondering whether I'm dealing with the impedance match or what is the cause of that, there are two lamps. First is overload. The amplifier is still working. And the second one, it goes to fault. And then our amplifier automatically switch off to the standby mode. And it's not giving me the voltage. That's one of the problems that I have with this device. Now, talking about the lamps, John has extremely impressive lab. I was lucky enough to assemble my lab based on the fact that in 2009-2010 many of labs were collapsing, going to bankruptcy, and for pennies poor guy like me could afford to buy the lab. But what I could say, between Johns and me, we have over 500 devices end to end.